From the American Tobacco Historic District, this is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. Young Merle Hoffman was studying to be a social psychologist. She was putting herself through school, working three different jobs. One of those jobs was in a doctor's office in New York City. It was the early 1970s. Abortion had just become legal in the state of New York. When one of the doctors asked her if she would like to emotionally support patients through the procedure, she said yes. And her experience with that first woman, holding her hand as she agonized through the decision of terminating a pregnancy, solidified Merle's life work. Not long after her experience in the doctor's office, Merle founded Choices Women's Medical Center, one of the country's first ambulatory abortion centers. Since then, Choices has grown into a full-service healthcare center for women. Merle also founded On the Issues magazine, and she recently endowed the directorship at the Sally Bingham Center for Women's History and Culture at Duke University. Merle Hoffman's memoir is called Intimate Wars, The Life and Times of the Woman Who Brought Abortion from the Back Alley to the Boardroom. And Merle Hoffman joins me in the studio now. Welcome to the program. It's good to have you here.
It's a pleasure to be here.
What was it about being with that first patient that changed your career path and brought you to what you're doing today?
It was an extraordinary experience, and I describe it as a catalytic event, an epiphany. You know, at that time, there was no concept of abortion counseling. I mean, it was, in a sense, the world turned upside down. I mean, the day before abortion became legal, abortion was a crime, a sin, something discussed in theology or criminology classes. All of a sudden, the law changes, and there's hundreds of women lining up for services and facilities, particularly in New York, which had legal abortion 3 years before Roe v. Wade. So it was an uncharted territory, and here I was, 25 years old, and the first patient came from New Jersey. She was white, she was married, she had one child, and she was in terrible economic straits. She just couldn't afford another child. And so somebody said to me, go in, talk to her. And that's what I did. I sat with her, and, you know, I shared myself. There's a wonderful quote from Euripides that I always use and think about when I think about that first patient, where he said, woman is woman's natural ally. And I think that it was that natural alliance that just caught me, in a sense. And not only did I talk to her, but I held her hand during her abortion. And I don't remember her face, and I don't remember her name, but I remember her hand. And it was that intimate, personal connection that stayed with me. And I suppose, in a sense, I feel I've taken responsibility for her hands and the hands of thousands and thousands of women. And now it's 41 years later.
How were women making that decision before then, do you think? What was going on? How was that decision made?
Before legalization?
Yeah,
this decision is always made, you know, in the hearts and minds and in life circumstances of women. And if a woman made a decision that she couldn't possibly have another child, she had to risk her life. I mean, before abortion was legalized, you had the horror stories of the back alleys and all sorts of terrible things. You know, I started to use the coat hanger as an icon of what the future would be for women if, in fact, we went back to illegal abortion. So, you know, it was a terrible situation. The first time I heard the word abortion was when I was 10 years old in Philadelphia. I grew up in Philadelphia. And I heard my parents whispering and talking about this horrible case where a physician in Philadelphia had actually done an illegal abortion. The woman died, and he cut her up and put the pieces down the drain. And that's the first time I heard abortion. And it was connected with danger, women, doctors, and death. So, and then the next time I did was when I counseled that woman.
So had you imagined yourself before that moment, before you counseled, did that counseling, you know, becoming engaged in this kind of work?
This kind of work didn't exist.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I mean, it was another planet in a sense. I was studying to be a concert pianist. I had very talented musicians in my family, and I spent the majority of my adolescence practicing 3 to 4 hours a day or reading philosophy or history. You know, I was totally apolitical. And then I went to school for social psychology, and I was apolitical. I was not political all during the first few years that I was working at Choices and seeing women until 1976, when Henry Hyde cut off Medicaid funding for poor women. That politicized me.
Was it hard to start Choices?
Well, was it hard? You know, looking back, you do things because they have to be done, because it was necessary. And here we were, you know, there was a gynecologist, myself, and the other physician who I was working with. And we were working with a health insurance plan, and they were sending us their female subscribers. So it was, well, what do? The patient has to, you have to talk to the patient. You have to, you know, make a chart. You have to have a staff. You have to, you know, have a doctor. You know, you have to develop all of these constructs. So it was from that one woman that I started to think about and develop how to create a paradigm for women's health and abortion care. And I started to think about a concept called patient power, which is very interesting, because what started to happen is I would see women coming in for abortions. They tried to avoid getting pregnant, but they were given the wrong information from their doctors. So their doctors would tell them, oh, you don't have to refit your diaphragm after having a child. You know, you just use the same one. Or they would say, you know, if you go off the pills, you don't have to use anything until you have another device, or just use foam. So there was all of this misinformation. And, you know, it may be hard to believe, but at that time there was no internet and there was no ability to get information on your own. There was no feminist movement per se, no Our Bodies, Ourselves. So these women were sort of victims of the male medical establishment. And I said to myself, they have to have an empowerment. They have to be able to have knowledge, be able to have choices. So I determined to call that patient power, and I structured the counseling around that.
And in addition to the counseling, there's really comprehensive health care, right, including mental health care.
Right. I am a social psychologist, and I started a mental health center, which was part of Choices Women's Medical Center, because I saw a lot of young women. I mean, we counsel. We talk to, we facilitate. I can use a lot of different words for, you know, that one-on-one interaction that a patient coming for any health service will have at Choices. But we started to see that they had a lot of other issues, you know, surrounding their lives, aside from just this crisis of an unwanted pregnancy, and that it would take, you know, more intervention in other ways. So I started to develop more ongoing mental health counseling there.
And also started the magazine on the issues.
Right. The magazine started because, I was so involved in the music and in reading and writing it. You know, as an adolescent, I was writing a lot of poetry, mainly despairing love poetry. So I was very involved in the arts. And then when I started at Choices, all my energy, my creativity went into that. And there came a time when I felt the need to express myself in writing again. So I started the magazine, and in our first issue, I actually had a piece about my debate with Jerry Falwell, and it was the beginning of the AIDS crisis, so we wrote about that. And it started as a newsletter, and then, you know, I sent it out for free, and then people were very, very happy with it. They were reading it. They wanted to subscribe, and I said, oh, subscribe. Maybe I should do a magazine. So it became a magazine. Now it's an online publication.
Well, you've made it very clear that choices made you wealthy, but you've also talked about what you've done with the money.
Yeah, you see, money is an issue. Money is an issue for women in a lot of different ways, as power is an issue. And I was a middle-class kid. I had to work three jobs to put myself through college. And, you know, seeing women and founding Choices, there was just no thought about business. I was not a business person. Medicine did not start into a business modality at that point of time. So what it is you have to think of a medical practice or any type of service that someone does. And because at Choices, we were so incredibly committed to giving women what they needed, which was respect, compassion, and the highest level of medical care and dignity, that one woman would tell another, well, I went to Choices and, you know, I had a good experience. The other would tell, you know, that old adage. And I started from 2 patients a week to 3 to 4 to the point where we were seeing 50,000 patients a year. And that was for abortion, family planning. I also have a large prenatal practice. And a lot of my patients who come to me for abortion care at the time that they can have a child come to me for prenatal care also. So the money or the profits from running a licensed, regulated ambulatory surgery center, which Choices became, I started to see I could give back to the movement. So I had a foundation, the Diana Foundation, where I funded radical writers like Phyllis Chesler, Andrea Dworkin, you know, quite a few people. And I've also used that to give an endowment to Duke University.
You've been working on behalf of women's health and reproductive rights for 40 years now.
Right.
Where do you think we are right now in this country in terms of women's health and reproductive rights?
I think we're in a state of emergency. You know, many people say, oh, they're so surprised at all of this. How could they even think about going back? But, you know, being on the front lines of this, as I have for all of these decades, it doesn't surprise me because, you know, I've been through the murders, the bombings, the vandalism, all of the different strategies that the anti-choice movement has used. What is so incredibly interesting now is that I call it full frontal misogyny. I mean, now we're looking at these Republican candidates who were jumping over each other like kangaroos to see who was more anti-choice than the next. I mean, there's not even an attempt to say, well, we're not really wanting to take away women's freedom. No, they're right there. You know, no birth control. You know, now, this is interesting. Now, Arizona has just passed a new regulation saying that life begins 2 weeks before they thought it began before. So, in other words, your pregnancy will be defined by the first day of your last menstrual period, which means women are now pregnant until they can prove they're not every time they menstruate. So this is, as I say, a state of emergency, and the movement has to be aware, ready, and alert to counteract it.
You know, there's a clear political agenda on the part of many who oppose abortion, and it has also been a way that men and male patriarchy has sustained itself, sustained its privilege over and against women and their bodies. But what do you make of another argument? Is there a conscientious argument to be made, and can you respect it, that that is a human life and that human life does begin at conception? And for those who believe that life begins at conception, that you rob life, all life, of its dignity when you have an abortion?
I can respect that thinking. I actually believe that abortion is the termination of potential life. And I think that it is a tremendous responsibility, and that responsibility has to rest only with the woman in whose body that fetus is growing, not with the state and not with the church. And actually what you describe is it can be incorporated in the pro-choice position. I mean, if you described your feeling like that, I would say fine. Don't have an abortion if that's what you really feel. I mean, I also think that, you know, I've spoken to so many women who, you know, might say, oh, well, I had an abortion, but I regret that I did that. And I say, oh, well, that's fine. You know, you have the right to make the wrong choice. And there is an absolute bifurcation here, that you can believe that life begins at conception, that it is a dignified life, and that you are committing a crime or a sin, or no, you're committing a sin. They'd like to make it a crime. But what the difference is that you cannot, in my mind, criminalize an act that has to rest with the woman.
You had an abortion in your 30s and then decided to become a mother in your 50s. Tell us about your personal journey.
Mm. Well, I never wanted to be a mother. I mean, I always really saw myself doing something on a major, major stage. I mean, if it wasn't music, I wanted to be a great artist. Then when I started to get involved with this, I was so passionately involved with the work, I couldn't imagine taking a detour to be a mother, not the kind of mother I wanted to be. So when I did become pregnant, I was married, and I could have, I had all the external accoutrements to be able to have that child, but I chose not to. I chose not to. And I continued my work, did what my life's calling is. And then, you know, I would think every now and then it would come into my mind, it would be nice to adopt a little girl. You know, it would always sort of come in and go out, come in and go out. And when it would come in, I would say, how can I just restructure my entire life? How am I going to be able to do this? And then one day when I was 58, it came in and it stayed there. And it was so powerful and it was so intense that, you know, I just went with it. And I had to take two trips to Siberia in blazing white storms, snowstorms, and adopted my little one. She was three when I took her out of the orphanage, and now she's 10 years old.
And how's that gone for you?
It's the best thing that I ever did. I love being a mother. I love it. And I love it because it was my time, because I chose and I could give myself to that. I could not have done it when I had my abortion.
You endowed the directorship of the Sally Bingham right. Center at Duke. Why?
Why? Because I, first of all, they had approached me many years ago, about 10 years ago, for my papers. And friends of mine, like Andrea and Andrea Dworkin, et cetera, had their papers there. And when I looked at what Sally Bingham had done, which was to really basically start to collect a lot of the radical feminists, and not only the radical feminists, but the reproductive rights activists and the providers around the country, I thought it was an extraordinary thing and very, very important. And I decided that I wanted to ensure the continuance of the center and the work in terms of the historical record of reproductive rights and the struggles that providers and pro-choice movement has been through. So that's why I decided to endow it.
Do you find it particularly interesting that that center is here in a university in the South?
Everybody. Yeah. Yeah, I like to be in enemy territory. this battle has been called the Civil War. The Second Civil War, and sometimes I chuckle, and it can feel like that. But you know something, women's freedom and women's lives are just beyond geography. So if it's in the South, I've worked in Russia, I've traveled all over the world. It doesn't matter. I know that Bingham Center is critical in recording and having the history of this struggle. So I go where it's important to be, wherever that is.
You have worked all over. You recently spoke to Parliament in London, and I wonder if this struggle looks different from place to place.
Well, you see, if the struggle for autonomy, free will, moral agency is the same everywhere. That's why I believe reproductive justice is a fundamental human right and a civil right. But the tactics and the strategy change and are different. Now, in England, they have a Pregnancy Termination Act or Pregnancy Act from 1967 that allows legal abortion if two physicians sign. And that's been, and it's paid for by the National Health. And that's been in place since 67. What's been happening recently is that what they're seeing is some tactics of the anti-choice movement that are beginning to mirror what we've seen here in this country. For instance, they have, quite a few hundred anti-choice protesters around one of the bypass clinics. That's like the Planned Parenthood, Marie Stopes of London, around one of those clinics. And they have the same signs and they're starting the same tactics. So the government is looking at this, and people who are aware are looking at this, and they're talking about, in the sense, the Americanization of abortion politics in England. And they wanted to hear my experiences and really to have me talk a little bit about what to do if, in fact, it escalates to the extent that we've seen in this country.
Merle Hoffman, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
Merle Hoffman's memoir is called Intimate Wars, The Life and Times of the Woman Who Brought Abortion from the Back Alley to the Boardroom. She endowed the directorship of the Sally Bingham Center for Women's History and Culture at Duke University. Coming up after a short break, writer and lawyer Jay Luzzi documents the fight to preserve an Appalachian mountain. Stay with us on The State of Things.